You're listening to Dialogue from Illinois Soul. I'm Kennedy Vincent. Dialogue is an exchange about culture straight from the soul. Young people in Champaign say easy access to guns and lack of opportunities contribute to gun violence in our community. Youth crime was the focus of this month's Champaign County Community Coalition meeting. IPM Student Newsroom's Petur Fedchuk was there and has this report.
About 80 people gathered to hear a panel of young men share their experiences. Among them was Trayvon Gibson. He's 21 and lives in Champaign. He says guns are really accessible here.
Right now, as of today, if I leave these doors, leave out of these four walls, I can go get a gun fast and I can get a hold of a job application to apply for a job.
Gibson says he has a felony on his record, which makes it really hard to get hired. Local officials in attendance said lots of crime stems from generational issues related to poverty and housing. They say young people need more support to help break these cycles. I'm Piotr Fetruk, IPM News.
The late Clarence Shelley played a pivotal role in bringing more Black and Latino students to the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. The initiative to diversify the U of I campus, known as Project 500, began in the late 1960s, following the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. Earlier this year, in June of 2025, a portion of John Street was designated Honorary Dean Clarence Shelley Way as part of Champaign's Honorary Street Program. The street sign was officially unveiled Sunday, September 14th. IPM Student Newsroom's Adrian Reitz spoke with Dana Vickers Shelley to learn more about the life and legacy of her father, Dean Shelley.
So before Project 500, so in 1967, only 372 of the over 30,000 students at U of I were Black. Thanks to Dean Shelley's work, over 500 Black and Latino students joined the student body in the following year. Can you give me some insight into how significant that was for the time?
Think about how Champaign-Urbana and many communities were and many universities were at the time. Many programs that in the 21st century we completely take for granted, in 2025 we completely take for granted, weren't even in place, weren't even considered at the time of Project 500. Through that program, students who were in Chicago, East St. Louis, from cities in the South and various communities across the country saw an opportunity to learn at an excellent university, and Dean Shelley brought both his educational background, brought his humanity, brought his leadership to the campus itself, so he was able to act as an advocate for the students, act as a connector to faculty and administrators at the university, and made a huge difference. But over the course of five decades, Clarence Shelley interacted with, led, supported, advised students from all parts of the campus, LGBTQ+ students, students with different learning styles, students who were indigenous, students from different places and spaces.
Dean Shelley's story has made the history books, but you knew him as a person, as a father. What was it like having Dean Clarence Shelley as your father?
We learned a lot. My sister Pamela and I learned a lot. We were very fortunate. Both of our parents were educators. Our dad, Clarence Shelley, was an English teacher in high school, the high schools in Detroit, before becoming a counselor at Wayne State University. Our mom was an elementary school librarian and, in fact, a graduate undergrad and master's level in library science. And so from both of them, we learned to be curious about the world around us, to be prepared to engage with people from different experiences and backgrounds, and to want to read and create and make a difference in our communities. They both advocated that, and our dad was very keen on making sure that we had exposure to a variety of experiences and opportunities, particularly when we moved to Urbana-Champaign with the university being there.
What do you hope future generations remember about Dean Shelley's legacy?
One of the things that his former students have shared and share with our family over the years and recently is how Dean Shelley would ask people as they were at various places on the campus, do you know where the library is? As a subtle encouragement to go to the library to study. So when I think of libraries and my dad's legacy, I think of places where people learn about the world around them, learn about people who are not like them, learn about leadership, and take their curiosity to newer heights than they might have ever imagined, and take their own personal and professional journey to new places where they can make a difference.
Dana Vickers Shelley, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
Thank you so much, Adrian.
That was Dana Vickers Shelley speaking with IPM Student Newsroom's Adrian Reitz. Few schools budged in the decade after the Supreme Court overturned racial segregation in public schools with the Brown versus Board of Education decision in 1954. It took years for new laws, court cases, and federal funding incentives to push districts to change. But in Urbana, a group of determined parents convinced the district to voluntarily desegregate. And 59 years later, many students from that first integrated class are still friends. IPM's Emily Hayes has more.
Angela Patterson and Laura Hastings greet each other with nicknames from their childhood before I even start recording. I have to ask them to repeat what they said.
Go ahead, Angie.
I said, I'm Angie Burnett, and I got a big boot.
I'm Laura, Lollipop, yeah man.
Then they're off, telling stories without any need for my questions.
Was it at camp and we had to do an introduction, so we went through and figured out different things that we wanted to say. And at the time, we talked about boots, and they're not like boots like that you wear, but like the back of your head is like a boot.
Both were kindergartners in 1966 when the Ellis Drive 6 parents pushed Urbana to integrate its elementary schools. The district already had integrated middle and high schools. But this group of parents saw almost no Black students were graduating from high school. They thought their children weren't being prepared adequately in their neighborhood elementary school. Angela's mom was one of the Ellis Drive 6, and Angela became one of the first Black students to attend Yankee Ridge Elementary. Laura, who is white, transferred there in fifth grade, and she recalls first meeting Angela on the playground.
Angie, I just remember that you were fast and you talked a lot. And I'm like, I'm going to like her because she talks a lot like I do.
Their friendship strengthened over time. They went to camp together. They also did cheerleading and grew up as teenagers.
Remember, we'd go up on campus and we were supposed to do that. And somebody would see that my parents' blue station wagon and say, did you go to a movie? And then they knew I was busted. We were not supposed to be on campus. Here we were in our little letter jackets, right? Walking around.
Yeah.
While Laura and Angela had a somewhat rosy experience with integration, others weren't so lucky. Angela stayed at her neighborhood elementary for kindergarten for an extra year while her brothers transferred. She learned later that delay shielded her. One of her brothers was screamed at by white parents at Yankee Ridge.
I heard my brother talking about it on a radio program when he was talking about how they were screamed at. And I told him, I don't remember that. He said, you didn't go the first year.
She only remembers good things at the school, except for one teacher. At the time, she loved her.
When I tell you I adored my teacher, I knew her daughter was a cheerleader. I knew she was from Texas. I loved her. I thought she was wonderful. I still remember her name. Not going to say it.
But for Angela, first grade was too easy. She was bored and acting out in class. Her parents told the school she needed to be put in a more advanced class. When the school finally did assess her, she breezed through all the test books. But her teacher was unhappy to see her join the upper level track.
She threw my books at me. She threw them. I'm a first grader. She threw those books at me. And I was like, okay. It really was kind of a painful experience.
She still thinks about it when she interviews teachers for her church's Sunday school in Georgia.
Not everybody is everybody's cup of tea, but a child should never know that you don't favor them.
After college, Laura and Angela's families kept running into each other. Laura became a teacher in town and ended up teaching Angela's niece.
You know, my brother was a little circumspect about, because I think she was in special ed class or something, circumspect about the school until he saw Laura. And he was like, all right, we're going to be okay because we got Laura.
Angela lives in Georgia now, but the two are still close. Now, the data shows many schools across the country have become as segregated as they were in the late 60s, especially for low-income Black and Hispanic students. I asked them if they think states and school districts should try again. Laura says in order to grow, you need to be around people who are different from you.
Just so we all get along in the world, that we know about other people, but learn about other people firsthand. You can't learn it from a book. You can't. You have to have the exposure and have the opportunities, kind of like we had socially, outside of school and inside school.
Angela, for her part, says she's not sure whether the integration effort did all it set out to do.
Part of the reason why things may have, maybe not have gone as planned is because there was an initial plan and then there were compromises that had to be made. The initial plan of integration was that they wanted Black teachers to go first. But the kids went first.
But she says her experience gave her the confidence to walk into every room as an equal. And it gave her great friends. I'm Emily Hayes with IPM News.
This year marks 20 years since Hurricane Katrina, which made landfall along the Gulf Coast on August 29th, 2005. The storm was the most costly hurricane in U.S. history, with damages estimated at $108 billion.
And then you can see the intense hurricane force winds in the darker shading there moving on inland. So that's going to track right across South Shore, North Shore, Lake Pontchartrain area.
You find on many occasions that we've spoken to people and spoken with people today, their faith is what they're relying on tonight.
The roadways are impassable. The interstates are impassable. We saw block after block, neighborhood after neighborhood, community after community inundated. We saw neighborhoods where you saw just the rooftops.
About 2,000 people are still waiting to be evacuated from the stadium, and that doesn't include the number waiting to be evacuated outside the arena and those on the high rise waiting to be evacuated. So many people.
Recently, our Weather Realness podcast talked about the storm. Host Maddie Stover talked with Deanna Hens, professor of climate, meteorology, and atmospheric sciences at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign.
Deanna, can you tell us a bit about your background as a meteorologist?
Yeah, certainly. I have been studying storms of various different kinds for a long time, but I actually started in hurricane research. As a graduate student, I was doing work studying how different components of the storm can contribute to intensity changes within hurricanes. And that blossomed into a wide variety of trying to understand the cloud and precipitation processes within storms and how they can contribute to how those storms evolve. In 2005, I was in my very first summer of being a graduate student at the University of Washington, and it turned out that my principal investigator, my PI, my research advisor at the time, had planned this research experiment to study how hurricanes change intensity. And so we were going to be using these flights into hurricanes, both with the hurricane hunters from NOAA and the Air Force, but as well as a research aircraft carrying a research-grade radar. And we're going to collect these observations, and especially radar data within the storms to better understand these internal processes. And my most memorable flight was on August 28th when we were doing our sampling in Katrina and we realized that it had reached maximum intensity.
Were you on the aircraft?
Yes, I was.
Oh my God, wow.
Yes, so as we're flying around, you know, we were getting the radio reports back from the NOAA hurricane hunter that has taken these, you know, central storm observations. And that's when we realized that Katrina had reached Cat 5 while we were in air. And that's when I realized that it's a very interesting moment where you know you are witnessing a historic storm. And there's this intellectual, almost just surge of, oh my gosh, I'm collecting a historic data set in historic storm. And at the same time, your heart plummets into your stomach when you realize that by this point, it was well known that Katrina is going to hit New Orleans. And you realize that a whole lot of people are going to get hurt.
I'm also really curious on the logistics of how you would fly into a Category 5 hurricane and keep people safe on the aircraft. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, it's actually very interesting because I've done a lot of, you know, field experiments over my career, and I've flown into severe thunderstorms, you know, mesoscale convective systems before, and that is significantly worse than flying into a hurricane. And that has a lot to do with the fact that those kinds of thunderstorms have a lot of turbulence. They have a lot of really strong updrafts and downdrafts that will really bounce a plane around. Hurricanes are really interesting in that all of the most severe wind is really happening in the horizontal. The up and down motions are comparatively relatively gentle. And so as long as you're going either directly against the wind or directly into or with the wind, you're pretty okay.
Deanna, where did the failure and response coordination go wrong?
Well, it was identified after the storm hit that there were several places in which the failures to respond effectively happened. There was a lot of lack of coordination in getting the information to the public. And there's a lot of confusing messaging about what people should do, where people should go. And then also the buses, for example, didn't go into some of the neighborhoods where they were most needed to pick people up. And so people were left to wade through floodwaters to get to the buses that then took them to the Superdome. Now, it's important to point out that this was a known issue within the city of New Orleans that in 2004, it was actually identified through an exercise that FEMA and Army Corps of Engineers and other government agencies did as to what would happen if this potential catastrophic outcome occurred. And it was identified that the Superdome would be the place of shelter for residents who were unable to evacuate the most vulnerable parts of the city. The difficulty there, though, was that the Superdome itself was surrounded by floodwaters by the time people started moving towards that direction. And then, of course, as many famous images showed after the fact, the Superdome's capability of keeping up with the huge amount of people that were in the facility and not having access to water, adequate food, sanitation became a huge concern. There were bodies that were left after people passed away when they were sheltering there.
As meteorologists, what do you guys take away from this event? I'll start with you, Deanna.
This storm, as I said, I was a graduate student at the time, was my biggest lesson in one very unfortunately real fact. That you can have the best science in the world, but if it doesn't get to the right people in the right way, in a way that it can actually be used, then there's not much benefit that it can provide. And so it's not only that we do the work and fund amazing science, but that we actually translate that science into action. And there's a lot of steps and a lot of coordination to have to go into that. And it's actually what spurred my passion in science communication and risk assessment and science policy, is exactly to try to be a part of improving that translation into effective action.
That was Deanna Hent, professor of climate meteorology and the atmospheric sciences at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, talking with Maddie Stover of Illinois Public Media's Weather Realness podcast. Go to Illinois Public Media's YouTube channel to listen to that podcast and the dialogue podcast. That's it for this week's show. Our show was produced by Reginald Hardwick and myself, Kennedy Vincent. Dialogue and Illinois Soul are part of Illinois Public Media, a service of the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. We will see you next week on Dialogue.